headlines this hour. Muslim pilgrims converge in large numbers in the Iraqi city of Karbala to mark Arba'in, the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. Iran rejects claims by the Israeli Prime Minister against the Islamic Republic's nuclear program. And an explosion hits a residential building in the Swedish city of Gothenburg, leaving at least 25 people wounded. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Crowds of Muslim pilgrims are in the Iraqi holy city of Karbala to commemorate the Day of Arba'in. The annual occasion is one of the world's biggest religious gatherings. It marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. Pilgrims, most of them Iraqis, have walked to Karbala, where Imam Hussein is buried. Security is beefed up in and around the city. Prior to the pandemic, the events drew millions each year, but now the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign pilgrims to several 10,000. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala, with the tyrant of their time over 13 centuries ago. They were killed on the day of Ashura. Well, Islamic researcher Muhammad Nasser Biria says the first Arba'in held after Imam Hussein's martyrdom set in motion a resistance movement that inspired many freedom fighters throughout history.
A movement started, and as dominoes, the movements after movements started, and this is continued today, until today. And this resistance, if you see the great leaders of the movements for freedom and against the injustice in the world, most of them, they have taken their lessons from this resistance. And the people of Palestine and the people of Syria and the people in all the world, this is the real lesson that they can take from Arba'in, and that's why Arba'in is so important. That you believe that the resistance will eventually be successful, and you will reach the Arba'in. You will reach the point that not only the enemy is defeated, but also the message is spread, and you have guaranteed the movement to continue. This is the message of Arba'in.
Sam Mehdi Torabi is director of the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute. He says that some Western media downplayed the Arba'in event, making it all the more necessary for Muslims to have their own global media network.
I think this is something we need to just kind of, you know, realize and understand that there's no such thing as objective media. There's no such thing as, for example, the Western media covering the world in a fair way and covering news stories that go against the narrations. I mean, I think we should just get beyond this. I mean, it's getting tired. You know, I'm getting tired of talking about this the whole time. As long as we don't have our own media, you know, global media network, this is what it is. If we don't have satellites, if we don't have, you know, the technology, and if we don't have the software and the production of capabilities to have a global media, this is what it's going to be. And it's always been the case. And we saw from the very first day, you know, at the time of the events in Karbala itself. I mean, if it wasn't for Zainab, if it wasn't for Imam Sajjad, we would have never known about what happened. So it is the nature and the essence of those who are oppressors to not cover the news stories that are to their disadvantage and to propagandize whatever it is, whether it's their own actions or whether it's the actions of the people that they are trying to oppress or the forces that are resisting them.
Iran has lashed out at Israel after its Prime Minister Naftali Bennett accused the Islamic Republic of crossing what he called red lines in its nuclear program. In a tweet, Iran's ambassador to the UN, Majid Tafdar Avanchi, said that Israel is in no position to discuss its, quote, peaceful nuclear program when it has hundreds of nuclear warheads. Tafdar Avanchi added that Bennett's speech was full of lies. During his UN General Assembly speech, Bennett vowed that Israel would not allow Tehran to acquire a nuclear weapon. He He also urged a more concrete international effort to halt Iran's nuclear activities. His comments come as Tehran has time and again reiterated that its nuclear program is merely for peaceful purposes. Investigative journalist Tony Gosling believes that there is nothing illegal about Iran's nuclear program, and Israel had better be worried about its own.
Well, I think with the nuclear conflict that's going on in the Middle East, particularly between Iran and Israel, actually, there is actually nothing illegal or nothing contentious about the Iranians developing nuclear power. And we're constantly getting smears from the Israeli side saying, oh, actually, really what the Iranians want is nuclear weapons. Now, anyone that studies this knows that actually a fatwa was issued against nuclear weapons on moral grounds in Iran, against their manufacture. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing. I mean, for us as peace campaigners here in the 1950s and 60s, we have been nuclear weapons on moral grounds, and it's great to see the Iranians actually going along with that. Now, the same is not true, I'm afraid, in Israel. Although in the Old Testament it says, thou shalt not kill, I mean, we realise that the nuclear bombs will kill, if they're used in anger, tens of thousands, possibly even hundreds of thousands of innocent people. And so I think the Israelis also should consider, through their faith, the idea that maybe this is not a good idea to pursue these weapons. As we know, the Israelis have, they believe anyway, something like 200 nuclear weapons. And anyway, even if the Iranians did have nuclear weapons, this was proved in the Cold War to be actually quite a good thing to keep the balance of power, to stop a nuclear-armed country attacking a non-nuclear-armed country.
Yemen's armed forces have taken control of strategic areas located west of al-Juba district in the southern part of Ma'ri province. The correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif al-Washali, has more.
Following fierce clashes with the Saudi-led coalition's forces in the southern front of Ma'ri province, Yemeni forces have taken control of Hurra and Najd regions and the strategic Umra Beach region located west of al-Juba district.
Ma'rib is of a strategic importance because it has oil and gas, and this region supplies oil to all of Yemen. It is also Yemeni land, and the Yemeni army must liberate it from foreign powers that have wreaked havoc in the country. For years, this was a base for the Saudi-led coalition, from which they launched many operations to destroy Yemen. So the Yemeni army is determined to liberate all of Yemen's soil.
The advances, Millet said, will pressure on the Saudi-backed forces inside the city, as the Al-Juba district is close to the city and one of the last lines of defense for the Saudi-backed forces.
The recent victories of the Yemeni army come during the last phase of the Battle of Ma'rib, as the Al-Juba area is near the city of Ma'rib and is considered one of a few strategic districts of Ma'rib that remains under the control of the Saudi forces. After the liberation of Al-Juba, all the enemy defenses that have been protecting the mercenaries of the Saudi-led coalition for many years will fall. Victory is very near thanks to great sacrifices made by the Yemeni army and support offered by local tribes.
For months now, the Yemeni army has been intensifying its military operations to liberate the oil-rich province of Ma'rib. Meanwhile, the Yemeni troops continue to advance toward the camp of Saudi-backed forces in the region of Khashina, which was recently hit by two ballistic missiles.
Ma'rib is witnessing remarkable advances by Yemen's armed forces backed by local tribes who are determined to liberate their soil from foreign powers. People here say the Saudi-backed forces should leave the country before they get expelled by the Yemeni army. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Explosion has hit a residential building in the Swedish city of Gothenburg, sending at least 20 people to the hospital. Some reports have put the number 25, including three women, injured seriously. The explosion hit the building early on Tuesday. Gothenburg's emergency services says that the teams are still working to put out fires in the building. They say that several apartments and stairwells have been affected. Emergency services say that several hundred people have already been evacuated. The rest are being evacuated also. Swedish police say that an investigation is underway to find the cause of the blast. The French president, Emmanuel Macron, has been hit with an egg while visiting an international food trade fair in the southern city of Lyon. Macron was walking through the crowd when a man threw the boiled egg at him. The young protester was heard shouting, "Long live the revolution!" The French president's bodyguards later arrested the protester. In June, Macron was slapped in the face by a critic during a visit to southeastern France. That man was also arrested and sentenced to 4 months in prison. France says it has signed a defense deal with Greece to sell its 3 frigates.
It allows for the deepening of Franco-Hellenic cooperation on strategic issues in the field of foreign policy, in military matters, as well as in the defense industry, which has been concretely translated into the Greek decision to acquire Rafale fighter aircraft. And today, by your announcement, Mr. Prime Minister, of your decision to provide Greece with 3 Bellerophon frigates that will be built in France, in Lorient, as a sign of confidence and the demonstration of the quality of our relationship.
The deal worth more than $3.5 billion was signed at the Elysee Palace. Macron hailed the agreement as a sign of confidence in France's defense industry against competition from the U.S. He said the deal marks what he called an audacious first step towards European strategic autonomy. The Greek Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, said that the agreement will not affect the ongoing defense cooperation talks with the U.S. France has recently gone into a dispute with the U.S., U.K., and Australia, after Canberra scrapped a deal with Paris to build conventional submarines. Australia would instead build nuclear-powered submarines with U.S. and British technology. British authorities have put the military on standby to help deal with the ongoing fuel crisis, as fears over tanker driver shortages has led to panic buying there. In a statement, the Energy Ministry's Department for Business and limited number of military tanker drivers are in a state of readiness and will be deployed, if necessary, to further stabilize fuel supply chain. This, as shortage of tanker drivers has left many of the country's pumps dry. The shortage is due to new Brexit visa regulations as well as the COVID backlog.
It seems like these that have seen the British government considering sending in army personnel in an effort to alleviate the fuel crisis that has seen back-to-back queues or empty forecourts across the UK over the past days. Drivers across the capital especially have been involved in a desperate game of trying to beat their neighbour to a petrol station that was still lucky enough to have some fuel left.
I basically just ran out of fuel, but I've been trying several of them, and then everyone just been shutting down. So it's quite bad, really. You know, I mean, I never thought, you know, I mean, we're going to run out of fuel. I thought maybe one day we're going to run out of food, but not of fuel.
This morning, we are supposed to have a delivery. Because due to shortage of drivers, we couldn't get a delivery. It has been postponed till tonight now. To be honest with you, since the Brexit, this thing has happened, like, you know. A lot of drivers have gone back home, like, and hence, there is a shortage in the haulage industry.
It's empty forecourts like these that will no doubt be causing political anxiety for the government. But none will be more stressed than the British consumer, who might be wondering where might they get the next full tank in order to make it to school, to make it to work, to make it through the day. The Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, is keen to describe this not as a crisis exacerbated by Brexit, but one manufactured by the haulier industry, who says they need over 100,000 extra drivers to meet current need. There's also been a degree of blame placed at the feet of the consumers for panic buying and driving up demand unnecessarily.
There's no shortage of the fuel within the country. So the most important thing is actually that if people carry on as they normally would and fill up their cars when they normally would, then you won't have queues and you won't have shortages at the pump either.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has already announced a 3-month visa scheme to tempt experienced EU HGV drivers back to the UK to assist until Christmas. And the role the army could play is also being explored.
We are bringing MOD trainers in to accelerate some of the HGV training. To clear a backlog of people who want to carry out those tests. So there's definitely a role there for the MOD.
In the meantime, consumers want to guarantee that they are not left stranded. And if that means driving miles in search of the precious fuel, it's a journey they're willing to make. Amina Taylor, London.
The U.S. federal government is facing a partial shutdown as the Senate has failed to pass an emergency spending bill. The $3.5 trillion bill received 50 no votes after Republicans refused to increase the limit on federal debt. It needed at least 60 votes to be approved in the 100-seat Senate. Democrats say that they will try again before Thursday's deadline to push the measure ahead. That's when current funding to keep the U.S. government operating expires. The shutdown could lead to unpaid leaves for hundreds of thousands of federal employees and a halt to many government functions. Thousands of healthcare workers are expected to be fired in the U.S. state of New York for not complying with the COVID-19 vaccine mandate, taking effect on Monday. New York hospitals are postponing non-necessary surgeries to boost their vaccination rates. However, health centers in areas with lower vaccinations are facing a shortage of staff. The state issued an order last month mandating that all healthcare workers receive at least one dose of the vaccine by September 27th. The push came amid a rise in the number of daily infections and fatalities in the U.S. Authorities blame the hike on the outbreak of the highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus. Colin Campbell says that thousands of healthcare workers in the U.S. would prefer losing their jobs rather than being forced to get vaccinated.
And what these health workers are saying is if they are mandated to take this vaccine and it's contingent upon their job or their employment, they would rather not be working instead of being forced to take the vaccine. They say that because this is a mandate, because they would be initially being forced to get the vaccine if they want to work, it's a violation of freedom of choice over their own bodies. And so now you have what's a polarizing issue, even more polarizing because you have healthcare workers who would be there to treat people with COVID-19 who may not show up to work because they don't want to get vaccinated. It's ongoing. You have pockets of the population who are refusing to get vaccinated. Earlier on Monday, a group walked into a food court in Staten Island, a stronghold for the former president, and they chanted that they're did not want to get vaccinated and that it's their body and their choice. They also chanted USA and they made some very disparaging comments about the current president. So that's where we are in America. We have those who believe in the science, who have trust and confidence in the vaccination process, and then we have those who do not believe it and who think that it could be a farce or that getting the vaccine could actually be more damaging than the risk of contracting COVID-19 themselves.
North Korea's ambassador to the UN has called on the U.S. to give up its hostile stance toward his country. Kim Sung added that no one could deny his country's right to self-defense and weapons tests. He made the remarks on the last day of the UN General Assembly, shortly after the South Korean military said that the North had fired an unidentified projectile into its eastern waters. Kim demanded that the U.S. permanently stop its joint military drills with South Korea. Pyongyang has long accused Washington and Seoul of pursuing a hostile policy. Talks aimed at dismantling the North's nuclear and ballistic missile programs, return for U.S. sanctions relief, collapsed in 2019. And that is for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
a simple question.
The news that Australia, the USA, and the UK are combining forces to build a fleet of nuclear submarines in response to a perceived threat from China has surprised the world. Yet, no country seems to have been more surprised than France, whose embassy in Britain is here behind me in central London, and who, until recently, believed they were in line to build a dozen submarines in a high-value contract.
I'm delighted to join.
In retaliation for the lost contract, France has now recalled its ambassadors from America and Australia. Meanwhile, in the escalating tensions, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison revealed he didn't think France could effectively deliver the right submarines, adding this decision was based on the question of whether France would provide the vessels required to do the job, concluding, "Our strategic judgment, based on the best possible of intelligence and defence advice, was that it would not." As the storm over this future Pacific nuclear submarine fleet grows into a major international crisis, the potential impact could last for years, with anger and divisions exposed for all to see. Thus, the one nation unaffected by the Western attempt to contain Beijing's sphere of influence is, ironically, China. How reasonable is it for the French government to express such public outrage after losing this high-value contract? And what impression of Western unity does it give when Paris recalls its ambassadors from Australia and the United States? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. The USA, the UK, and Australia are planning to build a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines to try and contain the influence of China. How smart is this plan? That's what we put to the public here in London. This is what they told us.
I think it's not going to be healthy. Contractors are going to be a winner. I think it's going to be a thing where politics will always be politics. Someone's always going to always complain. I think China's a rising power, so therefore it's all these other countries are feeling threatened anyway. But it's never going to be good. I mean, if one of those by chance explodes, that's a natural disaster in itself, and obviously a loss of life. I guess it's not really healthy. And I think, like I said, control's an illusion.
Gosh, that's really tricky. I think that we have to be careful because China's power is increasing, and we don't want to be in a position where nobody can contain them. I think the world is the most peaceful when we all have enough power that no one person is a superpower, as it were. So I think it makes common sense.
Yeah, that's probably not the smartest move, in my opinion. No, I think that there's more. I think that there's better ways to approach that problem than that.
I don't really agree with any nuclear sort of power at all, because I think we should all be friendly to one another, and I just don't agree with that at all.
Well, my understanding is that they already had some sort of agreement with France anyway, so I can understand that France wants to protect their own interests. That's only natural.
Well, you make certain suppositions when you say it's in order to control China, and they've pushed France out. You know, I don't know the details. I mean, we know the bits that we've read in the paper. We know there's been a change in that contract. We know that France is very upset. But, you know, there's a lot more behind these complicated multi-billion dollar contracts and transactions. There's geopolitics, and I really don't know. You know, there's just, I don't agree that changing the contract is going to control China. I mean, that's a pretty bold statement, so I can't agree with that statement.
I think people need to get a lot of inside peace within themselves for this not to happen in a way where it's going to be all in a war, which not really necessary, but that's the problem. It's a communication problem, and it's all driven by ego.
I think that the whole, I think it comes, well, it seems like it's just coming under the whole, like, policy rhetoric that America is back with Biden. What do I think about it? I mean, what I'd like to see is us move, obviously, towards a world against the U.S. hegemony and towards more of a multipolar world that grants agency to the global south and in the context of China. Listen, I don't condone a lot of what China's done, but these things are very, very nuanced. And what I'd like to see is a more multipolar world rather than a hegemonic world, if that's possible, within a nation-state system. But that's what I'd like to see. So
I think it's a very interesting stance to take. However, this sort of idea of fire with fire has been something that has been done for, 40 years almost. So just changing it instantly like that to go straight to peace is something that probably isn't something that can happen overnight. It'll take time. And in the meantime, if this is what they think is the safest thing, then we've got to leave it to them, because I'm not one to speak too much about it, to be honest.
The French government is very angry because it thought it was going to build 12 submarines, and now it won't. How does the public here in London feel about the French authorities describing the Australian government as liars?
Yeah, I think maybe it's more subtle approach again, and not just everyone try and just maintain some calm strategies to this situation.
I mean, it sets a precedent for the future. I mean, this is not how people should behave. This should not be our focus. We've got way bigger things to worry about. For example, what's going on in the world now with the coronavirus and all of these conspiracies, and we really need to be careful with what we listen to and what we take into our minds, really. Too much money is being spent on weapons. Could go to a better place.
All politicians, every country, no offence to you, but they don't either conceal the truth, but it's like, I'm sure we can find liars here. I'm sure France can find liars in their political system. So it's, it can be a case of pot and kettle in that regard. So in that regard, French politicians calling other countries politician liars is, it's a bit daft,
I mean, our Prime Minister is a liar, so I completely agree with the French Prime Minister.
I don't know what happened exactly between the two, but they had a deal and they didn't respect the deal, so...
I think that's France, the type, would be my immediate thought around that. But to answer your question, no, I don't think it's reasonable, but it's not a surprise.
It's politics at the end of the day, isn't it? They just want to be who they want to be, and I think there's a lot more to it, and I don't think you need to get into anyone else's business, personally.
I'm not convinced that the French are in the strongest moral place to call people liars, because I think if you look back on their history, they may have muddied the truth once or twice. I'm sorry that they're upset, and I hope that they can find some resolution, but I don't think name-calling is helpful.
France has recalled its ambassadors from America and Australia. What message does this send China when it sees Western allies fighting over this 37 billion euro submarine contract?
Yeah, they had France had to react anyway, so...
Look, I just think it's irritating. I think China work the way China work, and we need to prevent irritation. I'd be looking at other ways to cooperate with them and work with them.
I think it shows them that the remaining countries in that alliance are pretty determined, and if France wants to take its toys and go home, so be it.
I think it just shows that we're children and we just don't get what we want. We've, in the past, we've colonialised everywhere, and now people are telling us what to do or not what to do, and we don't like it. So I just think people are just throwing a hissy.
I don't know. It's one of those things where I think China's probably just taking advantage of that, and... but then again, if the shoe was on the other foot, wouldn't they, if France, be taking advantage of it? It's just that I think they're complaining because they lost contracts, and it's a financial issue rather than a lying issue.
I think it points to maybe how naive the West is in this context. What does China think? I mean, China was the next global superpower, albeit if there is a multipolar level of governance at the international scale, but China is the... I don't think they care. I think they know that, you know, I guess it plays into their hands. You know, if they want to offer, like, let's say, in development assistance in sub-Saharan Africa, they can just be like, well, look at, you know, the West and the international bodies and look at them quarrel among themselves. And I think, yeah, I mean, obviously that it's something that plays into China's hands, but at the same time, yeah, I wouldn't know what else to say. Yeah.
This whole political nonsense is something that I don't necessarily, like, get really deep into, in all honesty. However, outing nations for their decisions isn't something that necessarily should be done, in my opinion.
We're not really squabbling. They've agreed to go into a pact with US, the UK and Australia. I mean, it's just the French are sore losers, as is generally the case.
Let's look at the facts. The initial aim had been to build 12 conventionally powered submarines in France. These were estimated with a value of 37 billion. The new plan is to build at least 8 nuclear-powered submarines with the USA, UK and Australia, excluding France from the project. Currently, it is estimated that America has approximately 68 submarines, the United Kingdom has 11 and Australia has 6. However, China, the country that the Western powers are so concerned about, already has around 79 and could easily build more if it wants to.
How does the public feel about claims that building more nuclear submarines makes the world safer? Or do they fear that this is the beginning of a new underwater arms race with China?
No, the person who's got their finger on the button will make it more stable. It's a deterrent, and that's all it should be used for.
I do. I think deterrency is a valid way to try and contain global superpowers and one nation completely overpowering the rest of the world. So, yeah, I do think so.
The whole nuclear debate is a tough one, isn't it? I can see both sides, but I don't want butter to be pressed. I much prefer other ways to find areas to common ground to communicate on and build relationships rather than that, yeah.
No, I disagree. Building nuclear subs is more peaceful because at the end of the day, if that deterrent isn't there, you don't need to use it. So why build it and spend loads of money that taxpayers are paying, you know?
Well, they've been a deterrent up until now. When you're talking about submarines, I guess you're talking about a nuclear deterrent rather than submarines themselves. So they've proved to be very efficient up until now. Whether we need to continue to have them depends upon the leaders that we've got. I think most people believe in diplomacy is the best way to solve a situation. But if you always have that one option that's available to you, so the so-called nuclear option, then it does make certain countries think twice, I think, before they do certain things. So, yeah, I think probably on balance, and I know that it's a very nuanced argument, but I think on balance is probably a good thing.
No, absolutely not. I personally worked as a commercial diver on nuclear submarines, fixing ships, fixing the panels and the metalworks and welding it all back together. And that stuff is super, super dangerous and shouldn't be allowed anywhere. Yeah, it's petrifying weaponry. So that shouldn't, you know, nuclear warfare is absolutely not the way to create peace, no, definitely not.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, what's peaceful for one person needs to be peaceful for the whole of humanity. So if we feel like creating nuclear weapons for our country is going to create peace, well, it's you know, it's displacing a whole lot of other people at the same time. So, no.
Nuclear power's never been good for that, has it? I mean, it just seems like it's a false argument. So therefore, I don't think it makes the world safer. I mean, the only people complaining about are those who already have nuclear power. And yet, they're complaining that other countries have it.
No, of course, you know, the less nuclear submarines, the better. I think in the context of, like, an underground arms race, what you were saying, underwater arms race, I think that there might be a bit too much emphasis on, like, tangible arms races and stuff when a lot of, you know, a lot of competition is digital now with, you know, cybersecurity and stuff like that. What do I think of it? Obviously, I think that our analysis needs to be updated for 2021, post-COVID. And we need to incorporate cybersecurity into our analysis a bit more. But at the same time, yeah, obviously, you know, I don't agree that that makes the world a safer place. But again, everything is nuanced.
Yeah, I disagree. However, I don't think I'm in a position to necessarily speak on the matter in any sort of academic backing on either part, in all honesty. So, yeah.
Using a nuclear submarine, if it can promote peace, then that's amazing. But they're not designed for that. They are a war machine. They're designed for one purpose and one purpose only. You can use war machines to promote peace, but it's all dependent on how they're used. So.
Clearly, that isn't going to be a productive answer, and people are going to feel frightened and worried and stressed out with that kind of approach. And it's quite an angry attitude. Talking, maybe, trying to unite with talking and compromise and working together than building more nuclear weapons might be a better approach.
Looking to the future, China already has a dozen nuclear-powered submarines of its own, and almost 80 submarines in total. So what will China do if these nuclear submarines are built by the West? Here's what the public thinks.
Well, they will fight against that and retaliate and build more to feel safer, which is not the best approach, but you can see why they would react like that. It's common sense, isn't it?
Yeah, well, one plus one equals. I mean, that's what they're going to do, just keep building out their force, aren't they? That's I think that's their strategy. They're not alone in that, but I think that's what we're going to see, just a race to increase arms.
Very interesting to see. I don't know. I mean, China's governed by some very clever people. I think they also want to go down the route of diplomacy where possible, but at the same time, if you've got particularly the US, I think, sort of trying to raise some sort of dominance in the region, that's going to cause some sort of conflict. But what you tend to have in these sort of times is periods of tension, and then a period of reflection, and then tends to be a period of sort of going back to the status quo.
I think they'll just build more. It'll just become a contest. And I can't ever imagine all of these submarines and war weapons being used. What would be left of the world if we all had to just start creating more and more submarines and more weapons and bombs, and then will we ever use them? And if we do, what's going to come of that? We'll just be destroying land, homes, people, like whole societies will be destroyed. It just doesn't make sense.
At the moment, I don't know. I know it's all very tense, but they just need to grow up a bit and actually start talking. Communication is key. And if they can come to an arrangement, they can come to a deal, then that's the best thing for everybody. So.
Well, I believe in disarmament. I believe in demilitarization, personally. But you have to get all parties to agree to that. There's agreements with Russia on missiles. There's agreements with China. And unless both parties or all parties who are involved in geopolitics and who have large militaries agree to de-escalation, a one-sided agreement is not an agreement to do anything. So unfortunately, sometimes you have to say, well, I'd really rather demilitarize, reduce our weapons, but if you're not willing to do that, if you're choosing to build islands in the China Sea, and if you're increasing your military and your weaponry, then you're forcing us to do it. That's not rather what, it's rather not what I would do. And I think, America in any event, and most other countries, European countries, have been on record as preferring de-escalation and demilitarization, but it takes two to tango, as they say.
Australia, the UK and USA appear determined to proceed with building a Pacific fleet of nuclear-powered submarines in response to the threat these countries fear is posed by China. But in doing this, they have made a provocative statement of intent against Beijing, while damaging their relationship with France, which had expected to win this lucrative multi-billion euro contract to build conventional submarines.
This defence initiative has therefore caused offence on a truly international scale as theoretical allies engage in a vicious war of words, with disharmony between France, Australia, the USA and the UK. The only country apparently untouched by the fallout is China itself. Once again, we see the irony of the Western obsession with Beijing's power, leading the West to look weak and China to look strong and determined without building a single submarine or firing a single bullet.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
for humanity. Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at corruption and how it affects human rights. We said there are many effects to corruption, and we are looking at the social effects of corruption. One of the major effects of corruption on society, it leads to the deterioration of a social and moral value in society. When you have a society that a portion of it, or those who, partially, or members of that society are corrupted, then it creates that sense of moral, the moral value goes out of the drain. We all know that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for example, He sends prophets and He sends saints and infallibles so they could rectify the mistakes of people. They could fix the corruption. There's a verse in the Quran where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says He sent the prophet and the messenger so He could deal with people justly, teach them adl, justice. So if there is no justice in society, if there is corruption happening, then automatically the rates of crime will increase. That's obvious. And the rate of vices, moral values, will be broken. There won't be any. Because, for example, the youth who don't have jobs, for example, or the youth who can't, afford to get married, or families who can't afford to have a house over their heads, when they become in such a state, it opens the door for them to go commit all sorts of crime and to indulge themselves in all sorts of vices. For example, they go towards drugs. You see a lot of youth these days, going towards drugs or towards alcohol, or even gambling and all sorts of things, just so they could get their mind of the misery that they live in such societies, where it deprives them of their essential rights, of the things that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given to them, only because some people are corrupted and they're taking their rights. So that's something that we need to keep in mind. Also, amongst other effects that we see due to corruption, is that it weakens the sense of social belonging in such a state. I mean, should I feel proud and honored to live in a state, or to live in a land, or to live in a country where I'm being treated like sometimes even worse than an animal, as we can see in a lot of countries? So it weakens that sense of in me. And that's why, for example, you see a lot of people going against their countries, becoming spies, becoming this and that, and sometimes even they end up corrupting their own countries by their own hands, because that sense of belonging is not there. You don't feel like you belong in this place. You don't feel you belong in this country. You feel like the whole country is against you. So why should you remain loyal to such a system, or to such a country, or to such a place? And we, as human beings, we naturally like to belong, or we like to feel that we belong to someone or to something, especially when it comes to our lands and to our countries. We take a pride in that. But when you see that the corruption is causing such a gap between you as a citizen and the government, then you say, you know what, this kind of system, I don't want to belong to it because I don't feel valued. As simple as that. Now, let's leave it up to here. We take a break and then we continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to IRIB English Radio, to the program for humanity. We're still looking at the effects of corruption, which it leaves on the social arena. One of the most important effects that it leaves on people or on society as a whole, corruption I mean, that the education system and the health system will deteriorate, because the health system and the educational system should be enforced by the state, and the state, they should put a lot of effort into education, because that's how we grow, that's how civilization grow, that's how countries advance. And also in the healthcare system, because people, if the people are sick, if diseases are flourishing, then obviously the society will be crippled, as you can see in some countries where certain diseases do exist, like malaria and so on and so forth. So if the government is corrupted, if those who are in power are corrupted, then the education system goes out of the door. Or sometimes you see people trying to fill that gap themselves. So for example, we see the existence of private schools, private universities, where they charge an arm and a leg just to provide your education, which should be provided to you for free by the government, for example. So, and then you see a lot of people, for example, they can't afford to send their kids to school. Or if they go to public schools, they get the worst education, which means my kids and your kids, they will not achieve anything in life. They will be either dropouts in their college years, or they go to university and they just don't learn anything and they never achieve anything. So that is a problem. So if the system is corrupted, you either have people taking advantage of this corruption, you know, by raising their own, bringing their own education to the field, or the system itself, the education system that exists, to be so weak to an extent where even a teacher wouldn't care anymore because he's not getting paid enough. So I said, well, why should I even put an effort to, you know, educate people? As we can see that trend in a lot of countries, even the most advanced countries, where teachers, for example, not being paid enough. And they wonder, why should I put on the effort? I'm just going to go to class, deliver my lesson in whatever way I feel comfortable, give them printouts, and I say, you know what, you do the rest. And obviously, with such a system and such a mentality of teachers, then the educational system will collapse. And the same goes when it comes to the health system, where people can't afford to go to private hospitals. If they go to public hospitals, they get the worst treatment to no treatment at all, because it's free. And the government doesn't pay very much to the doctors or nurses or the health system itself. So you have, you know, people falling sick who can't afford to pay their medical bills and so on and so forth. All of this gets created because some people decided to be corrupted and take the rights of those who are more vulnerable. We leave it up to here, and inshallah we will continue in the episodes to come. So until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.